On Easter Sunday, Muslim terrorists killed more than 250 innocent Christians and injured hundreds more with suicide bombs in Sri Lanka. Both Barack Hussein Obama and Hillary Clinton issued statements, but neither one could bring themselves to acknowledge that the victims were Christians. Instead, they call them Easter worshipers. There is a war on against Christianity, and it's not just overseas. The Muslim bombers in Sri Lanka were from upper-income families. These were not poor, desperate people. And that speaks to the influence of Islam upon its followers. They have been taught since childhood that the God of Islam, Allah, expects them to kill non-believers. It is the same radical clerics who convince these suicide bombers to blow themselves up in the midst of innocent people. People whose only sin was not believing in Islam. The clerics themselves never blow their own underwear off, and that should be a lesson for their gullible followers. We've come to expect radical Muslims screeching the name of Allah as they kill innocent Christians, but we do not focus enough on Muslims right here in the United States who believe as the radicals do, or those who refuse to stand up against radicals, who claim that Islam has been hijacked. There is more than enough justification for fear and concern about Islam in the United States. That does not mean we should hate all Muslims, nor does it mean that we should resort to violence against all Muslims. What it does mean is that we should take seriously the threats against us being issued from radical Muslims. I have a fear of poisonous snakes and venomous spiders, and I don't consider that to be irrational. I consider it the use of common sense. Both of them can kill you. Webster's Unabridged Dictionary defines a phobia as, quote, any persistent, irrational, and excessive fear of some particular thing or situation, end quote. Take note of that word, irrational, as that's the key in debunking the idea of Islamophobia. People who are deemed to be Islamophobic by the politically correct arbiters of acceptable emotions are actually quite justified in their fear of Islam, given the almost daily reports of violence perpetrated against innocent people in the name of that religion. We are told that not all Muslims are to be feared. Many are not part of the radical Islam, and I buy that. But why has there not been an outpouring of condemnation from the Muslim world against those who, they say, have hijacked a peaceful religion? Many of us rest easier if so-called peaceful Muslims tried to police their own radicals, but they remain silent. Some are silent because they fear retribution from the radical element. But many are silent because while they themselves are not violent, they share the goal of world domination by Islam and the establishment of only one world religion, Islam, and the imposition of Sharia law. Islam is a male-dominated religion, and it remains a mystery why women would seek Sharia law, since it subjugates them to treatment like cattle or dogs. The movement by the people of Switzerland to ban the erection of minarets in that country is in reality an expression of outrage by the Swiss people about what they perceive to be a threat to their leaders and that the leaders are not taking it seriously enough. So this was a clear message of concern. Of course, all the usual suspects lined up to claim that those darned Swiss are all Islamophobic. Quoted in the National Post, Professor Amila Batrovic of Toronto's York University called the plebiscite an unfortunate exhibition of Islamophobia. That sentiment was seconded by Professor John Bowen of Washington University, who went one step further, calling the arguments in support of the minaret ban stupid. Be that as it may, It seems that the truly stupid thing is the constant insistence by Western cultural elites that those who are concerned about their personal safety with regard to Islam are suffering from an irrational fear. The idea that we have nothing to fear from radical fundamentalist Muslims, in spite of the almost daily reports of wanton violence, is beginning to sound slightly shopworn in light of all that has happened since 9/11. A survey conducted by the Pew Global Attitudes Project has shown a steady increase in the negative perception of Islam in several key European nations. That survey shows that attitudes toward Islam have become more negative across Europe. For instance, negative perceptions of Islam went from 30% to 46% in Poland, from 18% to 28% in Britain, from 29% to 41% in France, and an astonishing climb from no discernible negativity to 55% in Spain. Curiously, negative perceptions of Islam fell from 31% to 23% in the United States during the same period. That can be attributed to the steady mainstream media attacks against Islamophobia. We are being lulled to sleep by the toxicity of liberalism. As we see an uptick in the incidence of violence in America by second-generation Muslims, it's fair to ask, as Raymond Ibrahim did, why westernized Muslims become radicalized. It's a good question seeking a good answer. Even former Attorney General Eric Holder said that the threat of terrorism has changed to worrying about people in the United States, American citizens, raised here, and for whatever reason, have decided to take up arms against the nation in which they were born. At that same time, Sue Myrick, who was then a member of Congress, wrote a particularly candid letter on radicalization to then-President Barack Hussein Obama. Myrick said this, "For many years, we lulled ourselves with the idea that radicalization was not happening inside the United States. We believed that American Muslims were immune to radicalization because, unlike the European counterparts, they are socially and economically well integrated into society." There had been warnings, but that these assumptions were false, and we paid them no mind. Today, there's no doubt that radicalization is taking place inside America. The strikingly accelerated rate of American Muslims arrested for involvement in terrorist activities since May 2009 makes this fact evident. Myrick named several American Muslims as examples of those who, while embodying the American dream, at least socioeconomically, were still radicalized, astutely adding, "The truth is that if grievances were the sole cause of terrorism, we would see daily acts of Americans who have lost their jobs and homes in economic downturns." Yet, though Myrick's observations were limited to the domestic scene, they raise the following more cosmic question. If American Muslims, who enjoy Western benefits, including democracy, liberty, prosperity, and freedom of expression, are still being radicalized, we do insist that the importation of these same Western benefits to the Muslim world will eliminate its even more indigenous or authentic form of radicalization. After all, the mainstream position evoked by most politicians and the mainstream media maintains that all U.S. sacrifices in the Muslim world, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., will pay off once the Muslims discover how wonderful Western ways are and happily slough off their Islamic veneer, which, as the theory goes, is a product of, you guessed it, a lack of democracy, liberty, prosperity, and freedom of expression. Yet, here in America and European Muslims. They are immersed in the bounties of the West, and still they turn to violent jihad. Why do we think their counterparts, who are born and raised in the Muslim world, where Islam permeates every aspect of life, will respond differently? In fact, far from eliminating radicalization, Western values can actually exacerbate Islamic tendencies. Hence, why second-generation Westernized Muslims are becoming more radicalized than their own parents. Some already know that Western concessions to Islam, in the guise of multiculturalism, cultural sensitivity, political correctness, and self-censorship, only bring out the worst of Islam's schoolyard bullies. Yet, even some of the most prized aspects of Western civilization, like personal freedom, rule of framework, have the capacity to radicalize Muslims. Consider this. The West's commitment to the law as supreme arbitrator for the Westernized Muslim becomes a commitment to establish and enforce Islamic law, Sharia. The West's commitment to democracy for the Westernized Muslim becomes a commitment to theocracy, including an anxious impulse to resurrect the caliphate. Western notions of human dignity and pride, when articulated through Islamic paradigm, which sees only fellow Muslims as equals, induces rage when Muslims, Palestinians, Afghanis, Iraqis, etc., are seen under Western infidel domination. Western notions of autonomy and personal freedom have helped to westernize the notion of jihad into individual duty, though it has traditionally been held by Sharia as a communal duty. In short, a set of noble principles articulated through a foreign paradigm can lead to abominations. In this case, the better principle of Western civilization is being devoured, absorbed, and regurgitated into something equally potent, though from the other end of the spectrum. Put differently, just as a stress on human freedom, human dignity, and universal justice produces good humans, re-articulating these same concepts through an Islamic framework that qualifies them with the word Muslim, Muslim freedom, Muslim dignity, Muslim justice, leads to what's being called radicalization. A new Danish statistical study found that Muslims are 218% more criminal in second generation than the first. Let me repeat that. Muslims are 218% more criminal in second generation than the first. While some of these attacks are clearly related to Islam, such as attacks on Muslim apostates to Christianity, and others, such as rampant theft against non-Muslims, would appear banal until one realizes that even robbery and plunder are justified by Islamic doctrine. As one UK Muslim cleric once clearly pointed out, the interesting question here is why second-generation Muslims, who are presumably more westernized than their Muslim parents, are also more radical. Lest one dismiss this phenomenon as a product of economics or some other grievance against European host nations, the fact is, even in America, where Muslims are much better assimilated than in Europe, young Muslims are turning to radicalization. Muslims are special interest groups who are regularly demanding special privileges, willingly or unwittingly, knowingly or unknowingly, following a supreme ideology of special favors in a society with regard to, but not limited to, prayers, food, and fasting, when their numbers are large enough. Until their numbers grow large enough, they are supposed to blend in with others so as to not defame their ideology or reveal its political agenda. Once made known, their desires and demands usually concern gender segregation, food preference, personal hygiene, product handling, prayer time, and special holidays. We are seeing that in America now, where Muslims are demanding that we observe certain Muslim holidays. They demand a special place to be set aside in our schools for Muslim prayer, even though students are prevented from praying to God. They demand that Americans stop eating bacon because it offends them. These Muslims know all about our society and customs before they came here. Why do they come to America if what we do offends them? It's all part of the grand scheme of Islam to dominate the world. And you cannot dominate the world without first dominating the world's greatest superpower. Every accommodation non-Muslims make for Muslims moves our culture, our beliefs, and our legal systems one step closer to Sharia law. The concession itself is the establishment of Sharia law. For example, around the world, many Muslims react strongly when someone dares criticize Islam. Why? Because in Sharia law, it is forbidden to criticize either Islam or Muhammad. Forbidding the criticism of any religion is certainly not a precept of a free society or of a Western civilization. This means that to whatever the degree of Orthodox Muslims succeeding in silencing our criticisms of Islam, to that degree they have imposed Sharia law on non-Muslims. When the United States government stops using words that even imply that Islam might have something to do with terrorism out of fear of offending Muslims, what has happened? Orthodox Muslims have successfully imposed Sharia law on the U.S. government. That has already happened. Muslims don't concede anything back. It's all loss on freedom's side and gain on Sharia's side. They take the concessions offered and push for more, and the West keeps conceding, thinking erroneously that they're dealing with people who have a sense of fairness and reciprocity. They underestimate the followers of Islam. Did you even know that the United States government allows Muslims to determine what American textbooks are allowed to say about Islam? In the interest of multiculturalism, some schools go much further and insist their students actually practice Islam. If you were an Islamic supremacist and you wanted to soften up Americans for an individually domination theory of Muslims, and if you wanted to keep them from stopping you until it's too late, you would be hard-pressed to find a more promising project than influencing young school children to think that Islam is benign. At present, 51% of U.S. Muslims want Sharia law, and 60% of young Muslims are more loyal to Islam than to America. I want you to listen to some quotes from top officials representing the Muslim establishment in America today. Muzamil Siddiqui, chairman of the group which dispenses Islamic rulings and the North American Islamic Trust, which owns most of the mosques in the United States, said, "As Muslims, we should participate in the system to safeguard our interests and try to bring gradual change. But we must not forget that Allah's rules have to be established in all lands, and all efforts should lead in that direction." Omar Ahmad, co-founder of CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the top Muslim lobbying group in Washington, made clear Islam's objective when he said this: "Islam isn't in America to be equal to any other faith, but to become dominant. The Quran should be the highest authority in America, and Islam the only accepted religion on earth." Imam Siraj Wahaj, the director of the Muslim Alliance in North America, said, "In time, this so-called democracy will crumble, and there will be nothing, and the only thing that will remain will be Islam." Imam Zaid Shakir, the co-founder of Zaytuna College in Berkeley, California, said, "If we put a nationwide infrastructure in place and marshal our resources, we can take over this country in a very short time. What a great victory it will be for Islam to have this country in the fold and ranks of the Muslims." These are leaders of Islam in America, not some bearded camel driver in a faded desert tent. At what point should our government take these people seriously? At what point should all concessions to Islam end? At what point do we value our lives above diversity? That time is now. We know who the enemy is, and we have their assurance that they plan to destroy our country, to ban our allegiance to God, and to replace our freedoms with Sharia law. If that does not concern you, look again at your children and grandchildren. It is they who will bear the cost of our ignorance. Again, we need not hate all Muslims. We need not use force or violence against all Muslims. We need only to serve notice that they are welcome in America only if they are willing to assimilate into our society and culture, and only if they disavow any threats to dominate us with Sharia law. We have laws against threatening people with death. It's time we enforce those laws against radical Islam. There is more proof that our world is upside down. Pope Francis traveled to Greece recently to rally support for Muslims. He urged Christians to be kind to followers of Islam. But he has never traveled to Muslim countries to urge them to be kind to Christians. He dares not. While this pope has been kind to little children and ducks, his thinking is way off base when it comes to the real world. Pope Francis rails against walls between countries. But the pope's home, the Vatican, is totally surrounded by walls and has been since 852 CE. Immigration policy to the Vatican is highly restrictive. So is their security. The pope calls for open borders and for the United States to take in all immigrants who might wish to be here. But in his walled fortress, he does not practice what he preaches. The Bible itself speaks many times to the need for walls for security. Pope Francis has said that there is no difference between Christianity and Islam. These proclamations by the pope are highly offensive and not based in reality. There is a great difference between Christianity and Islam. The Christian Bible does not command Christians to kill non-believers. The Islamic Bible, the Quran, does command Muslims to kill non-believers. Christians are free to leave the religion at will. Muslims who leave Islam are subject to death. I'd call that and other differences between the two major differences. When we have prominent figures like Pope Francis minimizing the danger of extremist Islam, it undermines the truth. There is a war on in America to legitimize Islamic extremism. Breitbart.com's John Hayward wrote about this, and I incorporate his thoughts with my other research. One reason to be suspicious of Washington's ability to deal with the threat of Islamic terrorism is that the same dodgy characters keep showing up as self-appointed spokespersons for the American Muslim community. The Beltway media complex is too politically correct or afraid of being labeled anti-Muslim to ask tough questions about the background of these people. They become unchallenged, unquestioned sources for a great deal of news coverage. Chief among these organizations is CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. When President Trump announced that he would nominate William Barr as the new Attorney General, the first opposition came from CARE, while the fake news mainstream media shrinked away from truth regarding CARE. It's important for Americans to understand that organization and the danger it presents for America. CARE was created by the Muslim Brotherhood as an Islamic extremist organization that pioneered 20th century Islamic terrorism and that sanctions violence against civilians. While it gets all of the attention from the mainstream media as if they were a legitimate news source, CARE represents the opinions of only 12% of the Muslim population, according to Gallup. CARE only has about 5,000 members, even though their membership fee is just $10 a year. CARE's financial support comes from foreign powers who back their efforts to deceive the American people. There is a notorious neo-jihadi group in the United States that masquerades as a civil rights organization. In truth, this group cares very little about true civil rights or religious freedom outside the practice of Islam. They constantly complain about petty slights to Muslim Americans, while ignoring far more serious human rights violations by Muslims against minorities in the Islamic world itself. CARE's true interest is the advancement of Islam, which its leaders feel is best pursued by pulling Muslim Americans into a disaffected bloc. The organization's strategy of fueling paranoia and resentment does build political interest and power, but at the expense of the very assimilation which has helped Muslim individuals become successful in the United States. In other words, when CARE wins, everyone else loses. CARE's sympathy for terrorists and its ties to them are extensive, well-documented, and have resulted in charges and convictions. CARE was founded in 1994 by alumni of an older group, the Islamic Association for Palestine. That organization, founded by senior Hamas figure Musa Muhammad, calls for the destruction of Israel and the creation of an Islamic state under Islamic law in Israel's place. In 1996, CARE condemned the U.S. government's decision to deport Marzouk as an anti-Islamic act. CARE's first executive director, Nihad Awad, publicly declared himself a supporter of Hamas at a 1994 forum at Barry University in Florida. One of CARE's original advisory board members, Siraj Wahaj, served as a character witness for Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. Rahman was the blind Egyptian cleric convicted in 1995 of conspiracy to bomb New York landmarks. My friends, we are being lulled to sleep. It is not irrational to fear a movement that has been responsible for so many terrorist attacks in America and around the world. It is not irrational to hate a movement that follows the dictates of the Muslim Bible, the Quran, which calls for the death of all who are non-believers of Islam. Islam is not a religion, it's an ideology. It calls for jihad as an ongoing activity. And jihad is defined as the struggle or fight against enemies of Islam. Simply put, it means waging war against anybody who fails to bow to Islam. While it is true that most Muslims are not terrorists, it is also true that most terrorists are Muslims. So how are we supposed to not fear or hate or have prejudice against a movement that calls for violence against non-believers, a movement that encourages its followers to lie to those non-believers about their true intentions of Islam to control the world? We better start paying attention. When Barack Hussein Obama was in power, he did more for Muslims than all presidents of the United States combined. It was Barack Hussein Obama who took Iran, who was on its deathbed economically, and gave them millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars to get them back on their feet again. I hope you'll join me again next week. Same time, same station.